Okay, we're beginning here, 9 lines down on the top of Ted Vav Amud Aleph. Amar Mar, they're quoting back from the Braita, Yeshua Katav Sifro. Yeshua wrote his own Sefer, Ushmona Psukim Shebetorah, and the last 8 Psukim of the Torah. Tanya Kemanda Amar, this Braita supports the position that we find in the Gemara Menachot, Shmona Psukim Shebetorah Yeshua Katvan, that Yeshua wrote the last 8 Psukim in the Torah. Tanya, here's the Braita, Vayamat Moshe Moshe Eved Hashem. So the problem is obvious, which is how is Moshe writing that he already passed away? So how do you deal with those last 8 psukim? Efshar Moshe Chai V'Katav Vayamat Sham Moshe. How could it be that he's alive and he's writing, in essence, what is a falsehood that Moshe already had passed away? Ela Adkan Katav Moshe Mikan Ve'Elech Katav Yoshua. Till that point in time, Moshe wrote. Yoshua is Mashlim, finishes the last 8 psukim in the Torah. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That's Rabbi Yehuda's position, and then that would accord with the Braita that we're bringing over here, that Yoshua was the author of those last 8 psukim of the Torah. V'amri la, Rabbi Nechemia. Some say this was a position authored by Rabbi Nechemia. Amalo Rabbi Shimon, Efshar Sefer Torah Chaser Otachat. Is it possible that the Sefer Torah is missing even a single letter? The pasuk says, "Lakoach et Sefer Torah hazeh." The Sefer Torah sounds like this Sefer Torah, the full Sefer Torah. Ella, ad kana Kodesh Baruch Hu omer. Until that point in time, Kodesh Baruch Hu was dictating to Moshe. Moshe omer v'kotev. That's the girsa that we have. You can see that some eliminate omer from the girsa. Moshe omer v'kotev. Moshe repeated it and wrote it down. Mikan ve'elech, Kodesh Baruch Hu omer. Kodesh Baruch Hu spoke, Moshe kotev bedema. Moshe was writing in tears. Rashi in Menachot explains that the general way that a sofer writes, and from this there are halakhic implications, that when the sofer writes, Hashem is dictating, then Moshe repeats what Hashem says, and then he writes, which is a demand maybe on the sofer, when he is writing the Sefer Torah, not only to look in the book, which he has to do, he has to look in whatever he's writing, he has to have a written version of it, and be ma'atik, copy from that written version, but based on this, he would also have to articulate that which he is writing. Not only does he have to look at it, he has to say whatever he's about to write, and that's what Moshe is doing. Shem is dictating, Moshe is repeating, and then writing it down. But this last piece, that was not the case, but rather, Hashem was dictating, and Moshe was writing in tears. He's writing in tears because he's writing about his own death. But the absence in the second half is the fact that he's not repeating that which was dictated to him. He's not articulating that which was dictated to him. He's just writing it. That's one way to draw the distinction. If you eliminate the terms omer in the first part, then you have to explain the difference. Ad kan HaKadosh Baruch Hu omer u'Moshe kotev. Till that point, Hashem was dictating, Moshe's writing. After that point, Hashem is dictating. And Moshe is writing in tears, which the Yad Ramah and the Ritva take very literally, that the earlier part of the Torah was written b'dyo, in ink, and the latter part of the Torah, those last psukim, were written in tears, that there was no ink, it was tears that left a mark, and then afterwards they filled in the ink part of it on the tears that were written there. So they take it very literally, or you take it just at face value, it would say that in the first part, Moshe is just writing because these are events that have transpired. In the last part, Moshe is writing and crying about his own demise, his own death, and that's why it's kotev bedema, and that's the unique aspect of it. K'moshen emar lahalan, like it says in Yirmiyahu. V'yom lehem baruch mipiv yikra ilai et kol advarim ha'ile. That Yirmiyahu would dictate to me and speak to me all of these things. V'ani kotev al sefer badyo. And I would write on the Sefer in ink. So now, the question is, what is this pasuk from Yirmiyahu helping us with? If you go with the pshat that we said before, that there's a difference between the first part of the Torah, where Hashem dictates, Moshe repeats and writes, versus the last 8 psukim where Hashem dictates and Moshe just writes without repeating, then that's what this pasuk is supporting. Which is this pasuk in Baruch is writing down the keynote. He's writing down the negative things, the Eicha, that Yirmiyahu is dictating. And therefore, this is bad news or things that are very sad and hard to write. And therefore, you only have a dictation and a writing, not a dictation and not a repeat of those words. And that's what the pasuk would support. Otherwise, if you read it in another way, you have to say that, as Rashi says, The Kamar Kodesh Baruch Hu Omer, Moshe Kotev. Kamar Shematzinu Shnevim Kotvim Mipi Rabbam. So then Rashi says, otherwise, it's a broader din that emanates from this, which is simply the way that it's written is someone dictates, and the other person writes. Hashem was dictating before, and Moshe was writing. Over here, you see Yirmiyahu dictating, and Baruch is writing. So that would be the support that you bring from here, or the fact that we find the Navi is writing about something in the future. And here he's writing the Gilat Echa, which is a description of the destruction of Yerushalayim, which has yet to take place. It's being written in the future about a future event. So we see here that even though the event is a very terrible, tragic event, nevertheless, it's still written ahead of time, despite the fact that it's recording an event as if it happened in the past, as if it's already transpired. So I'll be support again for this idea that the last eight psukim, even though they are in the future and a tragic thing that Moshe is going to pass away, nevertheless, he still wrote them in advance of that event. So, Ahad Amar Rabbi Yeshua Baraba, Amar Rabbi Gido Marav, Shmona Psukim Shebetorah Yechid Korei Otan. So now we have a locha that the last eight psukim, I'll just read it at face value right now, an individual reads them. Leima, that this halocha would only follow the position of Rabbi Yehudahi, Udalog Rabbi Shimon, and it's not like Rabbi Shimon. Afilu Taima Rabbi Shimon. The Gemara says, no, you can even include Rabbi Shimon. Oh, Vishtanu Ishtanu. Since they were different, they were different. So the Havamina of the Gemara is that this should only apply if the last eight psukim are written by Yoshua. That's why you would somehow delineate them halachically and have a different rule with regards to these eight psukim. The Gemara comes back and says, even according to Rabbi Shimon, the psukim are not identical to the psukim of the Torah. For whatever reason we described here, they're different. Either they're written in tears, they're written while Moshe is crying, they're written without Moshe articulating that which is being written. There is a difference in these psukim that delineates them separately, and then the halacha can apply to them. What the halacha is difficult to understand. It says, the last eight psukim, yachid korei otan. An individual reads them. Rashi over here says, klomar, ein mafsikin behen. You're not allowed to interrupt them. Rashi Menachot says even more explicitly that you're not allowed to divide them up. It has to be a single aliyah. Those psukim, you don't divide those psukim up. And Tosafot brings a similar pshat here about the fact that you're not allowed to break up the psukim. You have to give the aliyah to one individual. Now, that is the view of Rashi here, the Balei Tosafot. There are numerous other explanations to this statement. We'll go through a number of them. The Rambam, first of all, has an unusual explanation. So unusual that the Raivad says he doesn't know where he got it from. Can't believe he made the thing up. Rambam says that like the din that we find in other places where a tzibur that starts with 10 and afterwards people leave from the tzibur, you're allowed to finish whatever section of tefillah that you're in. Similarly here, this is a part of the Sefer Torah that can be read without a minyan. If the minyan disappears, you can finish up the last eight psukim without a minyan. That's what it means yachid korei otan. Individuals can read them as opposed to a Tzibur, as opposed to a minyan. So that's another explanation that's given. The Mordechai gives an explanation that's also brought by later commentaries, that yachid means an individual who is unique, or miyuchad shebit tzibur, that this aliyah is given to someone who is chashuv within the tzibur. It's an aliyah for the Talmud Chacham, for the rabbi, but someone in the tzibur is deserving it. That's what it means, yachid korei otan. The yachid, the individual, that unique individual, should read them. Others suggest that Yachid Korei Otan, Rabbi Ninu Meshubam over here, is brought in the Balei Tosafot. The Yachid Korei Otan is that the Shliach Tzibur cannot read along with the person getting the Aliyah. Which is interesting, Tosafot just deals with the historical aspect of that, and he says it seems unusual because in the time of the Gemara, whoever got the Aliyah read for themselves. And you're not allowed to read, the Gemara Megillah says, have two people read the Torah together. Because trei kalei lo mishtameh, you can't hear two people at once, and therefore you can only have one person reading the Torah at a time. So first of all, Tosafot says, there's no part of the Torah you can read with two people. Number two is, in the time of the Gemara, they weren't reading with the Shliach Tzibur and the Baal Aliyah. Only the person who got the Aliyah had to read the Sefer. So he says, I don't understand what the Rabbeinu Meshulam is saying, and goes on to explain, how come today we have two people reading the Torah? We have the Shliach Tzibur, the Baal Koreh, who's reading, and the one who gets the Aliyah is reading alongside of him. How come we allow that? So Tosafot first of all gives the principle, which is Shlo Levayish, to not embarrass those that don't know how to read the Torah. It's a principle that we see by Mikra Bikurim, The Mishnah tells us that in the beginning, they used to have it be that anybody who knew Mikra Bikurim would read themselves. Whoever couldn't read or didn't know Mikra Bikurim, they would prompt him. They would read in front of him and he would follow them word for word. But then what happened was people who didn't know how to read stopped coming up because they were embarrassed by the fact that they didn't have that skill set. And so they stopped coming. So then they were mitakein, that they read for everyone, that they prompt everyone who goes over there so that nobody would be embarrassed by their illiteracy. And so that's, they changed the halacha with regards to Mikra Bikurim, that now instead of everybody just reading on their own, they had somebody prompt them and read. In the end, it's the same thing. You're reading it, but everybody was prompted. Similar to what we do under the chuppah, that the Birkat Erusin is made by the Rav. Even though technically the Birkat Erusin should have been made by the Chatan, it's the same problem that certain Chatanim didn't know how to make the bracha. So therefore, they moved the whole bracha over to the Rav, so they wouldn't have that issue. Tosfot says the same thing here with regards to Kriyat Torah. In order not to embarrass those that don't know how to read the Torah, we're not prepared to read the Torah, they have a Baal Koreh who reads. And he reads for everybody, even for those that know how to read. He still reads on their behalf. When you have the Shliach Tzibur reading and the person who gets the Aliyah has to read an undertone along with him because he made the brachot, so he needs to read the Torah. He reads in a lower tone so that he doesn't disturb the Tzibur. The Tzibur is really only hearing it from the Baal Koreh, not from the person who got the Aliyah. And that's the source for that practice. But that practice has nothing to do with our situation over here. But rather, says that Rashi, which is that the Yachid Koreotan means that you can't split up these psukim, you can't divide these psukim into two aliyot. They have to be read as one unit together because of their uniqueness. They are a unique set of psukim, and therefore we don't break them up. They have their own status, and that's why you have to put them together or bundle them together as a unit. The Mbalei Tosafot go on to explain also other halachot that we have with regards to Kriyat Torah, about how many people have to be standing up there. And to simulate, basically, the Matan Torah, which is that Torah was given by Sir Sur, through a middleman, through a broker, which is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to Moshe, and then Moshe conveyed the information to Bnei Yisrael. And therefore, you have to have up there individuals who represent those parties. So you have an Agabai, who's like, quote-unquote, Kibiyachol HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Then you have the Shliach Tzibor, who's the Baal Koreh, who's like Moshe Rabbeinu conveying it. And then you have the Aliyah, the person getting the Aliyah, who is like Bnei Yisrael, receiving it. So he talks about the number of people you need to be up at the Bima, or to have people surrounding him on both sides. All of these dinim derive from what Tosfot is speaking about over here. They happen to be a sidebar to what we're speaking about here, which is the last eight psukim in the Torah. And the last eight psukim in the Torah, the fact that the Torah is not shalem, is what bothers Rabbi Shimon. So how do we deal with the fact that you don't have a Torah that is shalem? So there is a suggestion amongst the Achronim, or Yaakov Endem, in the Shu'at Shela Yaivot, he writes or explains, who suggests that the difference in their opinion here stems from another machloket with regards to the Torah, which was, how was the Torah written? Was the Torah written as a single book? I mean, at the end of Moshe's life, he writes down the Sefer Torah, and he writes the whole thing from beginning to end? Or was the Torah made up of parshiot parshiot, which is Moshe along the way writes down the parshiot as things are happening? He writes them down. They're written section by section, including the history that came that could have been written beforehand. So all of these things are sections, and then later on they're put together to create the full Sefer Torah. So what he suggests is that the machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon relies on that exact issue, which is that if you believe the Sefer Torah is written as one unit, and it has to be shalem and complete, then it's very difficult to have it be that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't write the last eight psukim because the Torah is given as a full unit. On the other hand, if you believe the Torah is a compendium of smaller units that were put together, then it's less of an issue because the Torah is not given as a unit. It was given piecemeal. Later on, they took the piecemeal and made it into Sefer Torah Zeh. Then it became the Sefer Torah when they aggregated it together. If you do that, then you could argue that those late estate psukim being written by Yeshua is not a big deal, because the whole Torah is written piecemeal, and then you take those piecemeals and put them together to become what is the Sefer Torah. So he connects this machloket to that other machloket about how the Sefer Torah was written or put together, and based on that, it leads to their difference in opinions over here with regards to question as to who wrote the last eight psukim. The other thing that is mentioned by some of the Achronim as well is, why is it that Yachid Koreotan? Why is it that you have to give them a separate or segregated Aliyah, this last set? So the Yarot Devash suggests that Yachid Koreltan is that the Chashuv Shibit Zibor, like the Mordechai says, they give it to someone special because what they did was, in the time of the Gemara, when they got an Aliyah, the first person who got the first Aliyah made a Bracha, and the person who got the last Aliyah made the Bracha. There were no Brachot in between. That's a later institution to have every Aliyah have a separate Bracha, Gzera Mishuma Yotzim, Gzera Mishuma Nichnasim. So they changed the way that we do it. So now anybody who gets Aliyah makes a Bracha before and after. But in their day, the first Aliyah made the first Bracha, the last Aliyah made the last Bracha. That's why those Aliyot were special or unique, because the person who got those Aliyah got to make the Bracha. So that was special or unique about it. So that's what they suggest over here. What does it mean, Yachid Koreotan? That you give it to the Chashuva Tzibur, because there's a demand to make separate brachot on this section of the Torah. Which is that even in time of the Gemara, the person who got the first Aliyah would make the bracha. Person who got the last Aliyah would make the bracha. That's before these eight psukim. These eight psukim would get their own bracha bifnei atzma. Why? Because they're unique. These psukim are different than the rest of the Torah, no matter which position you hold over here. Whether you hold that Yeshua wrote them or Moshe wrote them in a different manner, they're unique. So you make a separate bracha on them. Ah, making a bracha? That was, in their day, was a big kavod. To be the one who makes the brachot on the Torah, that was a big kavod. That's why they gave it to the Gadol Shebet Zibor. Because he got to make that Aliyah, make the bracha before and after. That was unique. In our day, everybody does that. But in their day, nobody did that. Nobody got the first and last Aliyah. Here, in one Aliyah, you get to say the bracha Rishona and Achrona. And that's why they gave it to the Chashuv Shebet Zibor, because it was a big schut to be able to make the bracha both before and after on these sukim. So the other thing to note, you can look at the Rishonim or the Farshei Tanakh over there. For instance, like the Eben Ezra already says that from before this last day psukim that were not written by Moshe, he expands the number of psukim that here the Gemara says eight psukim. The Eben Ezra says even from before that point in time, Moshe Rabbeinu was already not writing and it was written by Yeshua. The Eben Ezra has other psukim in the Torah that he also says that were written at a later time or added in later. So that's anyway, it's a controversial statement, because you have other Rishonim, like the Rabbeinu Bachai over there, that take Eben Ezra to tax about the fact that he says that the Psukim were not written by Moshe Rabbeinu. But you do have opinions like that, like the Eben Ezra. I just will note that I think it's interesting, because philosophically, what does it mean that the last day Psukim are not written by Moshe Rabbeinu? According to the opinion that are written by Moshe Rabbeinu, it's easy to understand. It also maintains what I call the integrity of the Torah. On the other hand, when you have Yeshua writing the last eight psukim, all of a sudden it may cast aspersions on the integrity of the Torah, because now not everything is Mimoshe Rabbeinu. You have Yeshua adding in psukim at the end, or eight psukim at the end, that are not really part and parcel of the Torah in that sense. Here, so what do you do with that, or how do you deal with that? I just think hashkafically it might be an interesting message, which is that even though Moshe Rabbeinu was unique, and the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu was unique, there is a place for the next generation to be there. And the fact that Yeshua writes the last eight psukim is an indication that he's going to carry the mantle and the torch of Moshe Rabbeinu afterwards. And then in every generation that we are going to be the Mesorah, is going to be dependent on those leaders of the generation of the next generation. So that Torah Moshe really is not only Moshe Rabbeinu, it depends on us. And the Mesorah that we continue through the Torah that Moshe gave. And that's indicated through Yoshua's writing of those last eight psukim. So I want to suggest that the Torah times will take risks to teach us an important lesson. For instance, as Rashi says, by Naseh Adam B'Tzalmeinu, that teaches us Derech Eretz. And here too, the Torah took a risk to teach us an important lesson of the Mesorah. By embedding Divrei Yoshua in Torah Moshe, the Torah emphasizes that Torah Moshe, with all its unique attributes, is only Torah Moshe because of the Mesorah of Yeshua. While no one person is Moshe or can create Torah Moshe, nevertheless, each individual is essential in the transmission of the Mesorah. And in that sense, they help to create or maintain Torah Moshe. No matter how irrelevant or insignificant any individual might feel due to the nature of the Mesorah, they have a chapter to write in Torah Moshe. And the Torah teaches us that lesson by making Torah Yoshua, with all of its halachic shortcomings, a part of Torah Moshe. And that's why the Torah includes those last eight psukim that are supposedly written by Yoshua, or have a different status halachically, and incorporates it as part of Torah Moshe. I'm saying in one sense, Yoshua gets to make his mark on Torah Moshe. Despite the fact that he's bound by Torah Moshe, he also has a certain impact on Torah Moshe. And his writing those Lady Psukim is an indication of that fact. Again, in every generation, nobody gets to add to the Torah. Just these Lady Psukim give us the paradigm by which it governs every generation, that each generation will have their impact on Torah Moshe. All right, so now the Gemara continues, Yeshua Katab Sifro. Yeshua wrote his Sefer, Vaktiv. The problem is at the end of Sefer Yeshua, it says, Vayamat Yeshua Ben Nun, Eved Hashem. Same problem that you have with Moshe Rabbeinu, you have in Yeshua's Sefer. The Aske Elazar. Over here, Elazar finished it off. Vaktiv, and just a little bit after that, it says, Elazar Ben Aaron, mate. Elazar passed away. The Aske Pinchas. So Pinchas finished it off. So they have different people finishing it off. Over here, you can understand why it's less controversial that there are others finishing it off. Versus the Torah, or Moshe Rabbeinu, having Yeshua finish it off is much more difficult or controversial. Over here, nobody has a problem that Elazar or Pinchas finishes Sefer Yeshua. Shmuel Katav Sifro. Again, we say that Shmuel authored his own Sefer, Baktiv. Again, in Sefer Shmuel, it says, Shmuel mate. Shmuel passed away. So how could he be writing, first of all, after his death, or how could he be writing about his death? The Aske Gad Chozev and Natan HaNavi. These are the Nevi'im that are extant at that time and are interacting with David HaMelech. And therefore, they are the Nevi'im that carry on the work of Shmuel. And so they're the ones that finish off the works of Shmuel. David Katav Sefer Tehillim, Ayidei Asara Zekenim. So David wrote Sefer Tehillim based on the 10 Zekenim. We saw that yesterday, who the 10 Zekenim were. We also saw that there was difficulties with the Girsa, as to whether they really were 10, and as to whom was included in the list. So over here, the Gemara is already dealing with this issue. It says, L'chashev nami Eitana Ezrachi. Why don't they count Eitana Ezrachi? I mentioned yesterday that Abraham was in the list. Abraham, the Gemara is going to say now, that Amar Rav, Eitana Mizrachi, Zehu Abraham. Abraham is synonymous Eitana Ezrachi. And therefore, when in Tehillim it uses Eitana Ezrachi, that's speaking of Avraham Avinu. That's why the list contained Avraham, did not contain Eitana Ezrachi. Ketiv Ocha Eitana Ezrachi says by Tehillim Eitana Ezrachi, Uchtev Otam, Miheir Mimizrach Tzedek, who was the righteous one that came from the east? That's referencing to Avraham Avinu. So here you have the one who came from the east, and also the eastern individual, Eitan, the rock from the east. And we know that Yerach HaEitanim, which is found in Sefer Melachim, the Gemara identifies with the Avot. So Eitan is a reference to the Avot, Ezrachi, that came from the east. That is Avram Avinu, who traveled from the east to Eretz Yisrael. So that's how the Gemara deals with it. Over here, you have a Ot Dalet that goes up to the Mesorat HaShas, and you can see it in the Bach. Rashi also brings this alternate Girsa and says that it's not in the Girsa. But then after saying it's not in the Girsa, he says, well, if you do have that Girsa, then this is what you have to do with it. Which is that the Gemara continues and says, Ve'ema Yaakov. Why don't you say that Yaakov was considered to be Eitan Ezrachi, Dichtibbe, Vayizrach Lo Hashemesh. Because it says by, I'm reading from the Sword of the Shas, what's now right now, it says, Vayizrach Lo Hashemesh, that the sun rose. So Vayizrach, Ezrachi, then maybe that's referencing to Yaakov. It says, and we Bayle, Shemesh, Ba'a, Ba'avuro. That the sun came before him, Zachab Avuro, in order to heal him. Vayizrach Lo Hashemesh, after he fought with the Malach, that came to heal him from the limp, from Soleya Ayurecho. So that's how the Gemara rejects it. On the other hand, there were versions that included Eitan Ezrachi in the list. Based on that, then you would have Eitan Ezrachi and Avraham in the list. If that's the case, then the answer would be that it was Yaakov. So that's what Rashi says over here. The Lishna Achrina Garsina on the Matinita Deo, Binyana Dasaraz Kenim, the Kachoshiv Avraham ve'Eitan Ezrachi. It puts both of them in the list. Avram and Eitan Ezrachi. If that's the case, then Eitan Ezrachi would have to refer to Yaakov, because you already have Avram delineated separately. But now you have a problem, because now you have more than 10 in the list. It says, V'loka choshiv Asaf. It does not include Asaf, because Savar mishlosha b'nei Korachu. Because he's one of the three sons of Korach, which is also not so simple, because of his name was Avi Asaf, not Asaf necessarily. But what they do to consolidate and get to 10 is say that Asaf in the list was not separately enumerated. He's one of the B'nai Korach, and therefore you still have your 10. And that's what we dealt with at the end of yesterday's daf as well with Tosafot, saying that there was a Girsa and setting Shlosha B'nai Korach. The Girsa said Shlomo and B'nai Korach. So that would have added another person into the list. So what do you do then if you add in another person? So either you have to drop one, from the list, which the Balei Tosafot deal with how they dropped one. Or he says that Shlomo HaMelech is wrong because he's subsumed under David HaMelech. Or you have to say, like the Rabbeinu Gershom said, that Adam HaRishon, even though he's in the list, he's not counted amongst the 10. So you have different ways of dealing with the Gersa problems and the different people that are enumerated here, because the Braita says 10, and we're ending up with more than 10 names depending on the Gersa. So all the Rishonim are trying to balance as to whom is mentioned or which are the 10 that are enumerated here, and you can see the Gemara dealing with it in the same way. Vamarav Heman Ze Moshe. Now you have another problem, is because the Braita enumerates over there Heman, and also enumerates Moshe. If you think Moshe and Heman are synonymous, then how do you deal with the fact that they're 10 and yet they're both enumerated there? Tevacha Heman, Tevatam b'chol beiti ne'eman hu. So this correlation between Heman and beiti ne'eman, Gemara draws a parallel between Heman and Ne'eman, that those two make them synonymous with the same person. Gemara says, Trei Heman avu, there were two different Hemans, and therefore, what's enumerated here is there's Moshe, who's identified with Heman, which Rashi notes over here, Maskila Heman Ezrachi, Heman Achrinahu. That when it says Maskila Heman HaEzrachi, Heman Ezrachi is a different person than Heman that we identify with Moshe. So even though Moshe is synonymous with Heman, the one mentioned in Tehillim of Heman HaEzrachi is a different individual, and there are two Hemans. And in Ochanami, Moshe is known as Heman, but there's also another Heman, and that's why the new list separates them. Right? Moshe katav sifro upashat Bil'am ve'Iyov. So now this is going to launch us into a whole section on Iyov, but it says that Moshe wrote his Sefer, meaning Sefer Torah, Pashat Bil'am, which we discussed yesterday, since it's something that came from outside of Bnei Yisrael. It was one of the Vieh Umoto Ulam, that had a nevoah and had the whole story about the curses and the blessings that have nothing to do with Bnei Israel. And Bnei Israel weren't even aware of it. And neither was Moshe at the time. Only after the fact are they aware of it. So you have to either explain what it's doing in the Sefer Torah. So that's that Moshe wrote it. So Moshe included it, so that gives it the tokif that it belongs in the Sefer Torah. Or you have to explain it was something important enough that Hashem gave Moshe the Ruach HaKodesh to include in the Torah, but it might still have a different status, which comes out from Gemaras and other places, that Parashat Bil'am, or those sections of the Torah, might have a different status of Kedusha than the remainder of the Torah, because of where they derive from and how they are added into the Torah. They're not a part of the story of Bnei Yisrael. They are something outside of Bnei Yisrael that impacts Bnei Yisrael, where that God saved them and shows Hashem's tremendous love for Bnei Yisrael, yet it wasn't something that directly involved Bnei Yisrael. Be'iyov, and he also wrote Iyov, Messiah the Rabbi Levi Bar Lachma. This supports that position of Rabbi Levi Bar Lachma, who says, Amar Levi Bar Lachma, Iyov b'mei Moshe haya. Iyov was a person in the time of Moshe. Tivachi, it says in the Pasuk in Iyov, Mi itein efo, v'yichtivun milai. Will there be someone we could find who will write down my words? Or in essence, he's looking for a sofer. And in looking for a sofer, he uses the term efo. Uchtiv hatam, and Moshe Rabbeinu says, after the Chet HaEgel, and he's pleading with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, he says, "Ubamei yivadai efo." And how will we know that we are still your unique people? So he uses the term efo. So the Gemara says, Moshe, who is a sofer, is known in the Kabbalistic terms as the Safra, as the sofer, the great sofer of Bnei Yisrael. So Moshe Rabbeinu, who is termed, uses the term efo, and also in Iyov, they use efo. So that Agadic Gezer Shava tells us that Iyov was using Moshe as his scribe. And that's why he was at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. Where it says, that seems to be a weak connection. Ve'ima b'mei Yitzchak tichtiv. Why don't you say he's at the time of Yitzchak? Because he says, Mi'ifu hu atzad Sayid. When he's speaking about Esav, where is the one who brought me the capture or the game that I ate before? Ve'ima b'mei Yaakov tifkiv. Ein kein ifu zot asu. When he's instructing his children when they're going back to Mitzrayim after they get all the money and the food and what they have to do, he's giving them instructions about how to go back to Mitzrayim. Ve'ima b'mei Yosef tichtiv efohem ro'im. So here it's a little more precarious, because over here it's spelled with a hey. In the other instances, at least it was spelled with a vav aleph. Although in Iyov, to be honest with you, it's spelled without an aleph. It's just aleph pei vav. So that maybe gives the Gemara more latitude over here. But Ephraim Roim, when Yosef is asking the, where his brothers are, when they went to Dotaino and his father had sent him to go find them, where it says, Lo sachadatcha. That's not the case. Tichtiv. Because again in Iyov it says, Mi itein basefer ve'yuchaku. who will place them in the sefer, and they will be inscribed in the sefer. U'moshehod ikre mechokek. And this is where the Kabbalistic term for Moshe comes. Moshe is known as the great scribe. Dichtiv vayar reshit lo. That when they took their possession, they chose the first lands that Bnei Israel had conquered in Eivar HaYarden. God took their possession in Eivar HaYarden. Kisham chelkat mechokek tzafon. The reason they did it is because the burial place of the great scribe is hidden over there. Moshe Rabbeinu is buried in their land. So they picked the land in Eivar HaYarden in which the grave or the burial place of Moshe is found. The reference here of Chelkat Mechokek Safun is a reference to Moshe Rabbeinu, and it calls him a Mechokek, the inscriber or the scribe that is hidden, which is that Moshe's burial place is not known. Again, that Moshe is known as the Mechokek, and so that parallels much more with Eov, because Eov is saying Efo, plus he's calling Mechokek. Those terms are both used by Moshe Rabbeinu, and that's how he connects between the two. Rava Amar, Iyov v'mei miraglim haya. Rava says he was in the time of the miraglim. Tiv hocha, because the pasuk says in the beginning of Iyov, the truth is that probably should read the whole first parak in Iyov, because the Gemara here is going to go and darshan a lot about this first parak. But ish haya be'eretz utz, Iyov shemo. There was an individual in a place called the Utz, and Iyov was his name. Tam v'yashar v'yirei elukim v'sar meira. So what Rava says over here is that this individual is ish haya be'eretz utz, Iyov shmoch, tivotam. When Moshe sends the meraglim into Eretz Yisrael, he gives them instructions about what to ask about. Hayesh ba'eitz? Is there an eitz there? So he connects between utz and eitz. Rava says, mi dami. That's a very, very precarious connection. Hocha utz, hotam eitz. One word is utz and one word is eitz. How are you paralleling them? Hachi kamar lo Moshe l'Yisrael. This is what Moshe says to Bnei Yisrael. Yeshno lo oto adam, sheshnotav arukot ke'eitz. There is an individual whose lifespan is as long as that of a tree. Umegin al doro ke'eitz. And he protects his generation like a tree. Meaning like the shade cast by a tree or the protection provided by a tree. So even though the words are not the same, when Moshe says eitz, he's talking about an individual has schuyot that will protect them. Someone who provides them schuyot, which won't allow us to overcome them because he's there. And the Midrash continues on that Bnei Yisrael basically couldn't enter the land or conquer Eretz Yisrael until Yov passed away. Because Yov was providing protection for the peoples of the land. And that's the Midrashim also speak about, that they saw that there was a funeral and that people were dying. The person who had passed away, one of the people was the Gadol Ador, had passed away, which was Iyov. Because Iyov was providing that protection. So he sees a connection between the Utz and the Eitz, not in the direct correlation between the words, but rather in the nature of the individual that they are speaking about. Yativ ahu merabonim kamei de Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, v'yativ kamar, Iyov lo haya v'lo nivra el mashal haya. So then one of these Rabbanon was sitting before Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani and said, Iyov was not a real person. Iyov is simply a parable. It's a story with a lesson in it, but it's nothing that ever really happened. Amalei alecha amar akra. He says to you, the pasuk says, Ish haya be'eretz utz, Iyov shemo. They identify the place where he lived, and they identify his name. That makes it that it's real and not just a story or a parable. Where it says, Elamiata, are you so sure that when they give you a name and a place, that means that it is in reality and it's not a parable? He says in the story of David and Bathsheba, where Natan HaNavi tells a story to David in order to entrap David and have David paskin the halacha with regards to the story. And then Natan HaNavi turns around and says, Atah HaIsh, you are that person, meaning that he's telling David that you sinned here and that you did something wrong. So he makes up a story. The story is, Udarash, Ein Kol, Kim Kibsach Ad Ketana. This poor individual had nothing to his name, except this one little kibsa, this one little you, Ashir Kana, and that he purchased, Vayicha Yeha, and he took care of, and that was his whole life, was this little you. And then the rich person comes and steals it from him, and so on and so forth in the story there. Mihava, did this person ever exist? So you see that the Tuvim or the Psukim are enumerating it as if this person existed. There was this rush, the poor person who lived and had all these things. It tells you a story of it's real, but it's still a parable. El mashal ba'alma, it's just a mashal. It was a parable used in order to ensnare David. Hachnami mashal ba'alma, so too by Iyov. Where it says, Im kein, shmo v'shem iro, lama. It's one thing to tell a story about a generic person or a poor person, a rich person, things that identify people simply by descriptive terms. To identify a person by their place, their location, and by their name, that's too specific to be a mashal. That is much more a story of reality or something that had transpired. And therefore, Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani rejects this idea that it is a mashal. Tosfot over here also notes that there is another opinion of Reish Lakish in the Bereishit Rabbah that is very similar in nature to the position that's being posed by this Rabbanan to Rabbi Shmuel Nachmani, which is he says that Eyov did exist, but none of the story ever happened to him. Reish Lakish says there was a person named Eyov who was a big tzaddik, and he would have withstood all these Yisurim. But they made up a story and used this person as the subject of the story, even though it never really happened to him. That's Reish Lakish's opinion. Tosfot says that the two are not exactly the same. This individual here is saying that Eyov never existed, period. There was no such person as Eyov. Reish Lakish agrees there was a person named Eyov, but just none of the events took place or transpired to him. So it's a different or a slightly nuanced difference in their opinions, but at least Reish Lakish believes that Eyov did exist. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Lazar Damrei Tarvayu, they both say, Eyov me'olei gola haya. He was one of the people that came back from Bavel with Ezra and Nehemiah. Ubeit Midrasho b'Tveria. And he was a Talmud Chacham, a leader of the people, and he had a Beit Midrash in Tveria, which is unbelievable, because that would make Eyov extremely late. Meaning that if he's with the Olei Bavel, that makes the story of Eyov very, very late. It means that whoever wrote Eyov would have likely have to have been the Anshei Knesset Agdolah, because it's so late. So now the Gemara challenges this from an interesting Braita. Meitavei, Yimesh Notav Shel Eyov, Eyov lived from the time that Bnei Israel went into Mitzrayim until the time that they left. Or in other words, the Torah says, records that it was 210 years. So Eyov lives those 210 years. Now, if you believe he lived in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, works out well. If you believe in the Midrash that says that there were three advisors to Paro, and one of those advisors was Eyov, works out well. Because that's when he's living. He's living from the time that Bnei Israel go to Mitzrayim till the time that they leave. On the other hand, for those that here that express that it was later on, especially Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Yochanan, who say that he was with the Olei Bavel, what does that have to do with the fact of Mitzrayim? What is it? That's thousands of years apart. So, Eima, Kim Mishash Niknusula Israel Mitzrayim Ad Shashi Yatsu. It's not that he lived at that time. He lived the same duration as their sojourn in Mitzrayim, which is 210 years. That derives from the Psukim, as Rashi notes. At the end of Sefer Eyov, after Eyov has gone through all of these difficulties, Hashem in the end rewards him and gives him double of what he had beforehand. And over there, it says at the end of Eyov, he lived an additional 140 years. If he got double what he had already, that means that he was 70 when all of this happened. He got double reward, that's 140 years. The totality of 70 and 140 is 210. And that's how we know that Eyov lived for 210 years. Although Rabbeinu Gersho says that the pasuk in Eyov even indicates he lived 70, because it says, "V'Eyov shubal olav yisrim ayah ben ayin shanak kidichtiv, gam sav, gam yashish banu, v'ein shev pachod me'ayin shana." So he uses a term that's mentioned in Eyov to support this idea that he was 70, although again, he brings the calculation afterwards, similar to what Rashi and the Tosafot makes the same calculation. Tosafot makes the calculation and says, it's so simple, it's so obvious, the calculation. I mean, why do you need a Braita to tell me that he lived for 210 years? You can make the calculation out of Psukim, it's so obvious. So he says, no, you might have thought that the doubling of his reward was regards to his material possessions, his children, and so on and so forth, but not with regards to his lifespan. So the Braita comes to tell you that that doubling also applied to his lifespan, and therefore he lived 210 years. Now, Meitavei, Shiva Nevi'im Nitnabulu Motolam. There were seven prophets that prophesied for the other nations of the world. Ve'eluein. Bilam, Ve'aviv, Ve'iov, Eliphaz HaTemani, U'Bildad HaShuchi, Ve'Tzofar HaNamati, Ve'elu Ben Brachel HaBuzi. So now, here are seven names. Including in these names, the obvious problem is Eov, because that means that Eov was not part of Bnei Israel. And if you go back to the opinion of Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Yochanan, they said that he was with the Olei Bavel, had a Beit Midrash in Tveria. That makes him from Israel. So this Braita clearly indicates he was not Jewish. The question is from the Braita that indicates he wasn't from Klal Yisrael, yet Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yochanan are indicating he was some sort of Talmud Chacham. So now the Gemara then is going to continue and deal with that. But beyond that, they have to deal with the names that are here. Bil'am, we know, was a Navi because he's mentioned in the Torah. Aviv, how do we know his father was also a Navi? So that's based on the principle the Gemara lays out in Megillah, which is that whenever a Navi is mentioned and is miuchas to his parent, his father is also mentioned. That means that his father was also a Navi. The fact that Bil'am ben Beor is mentioned in the Torah, that means that his father must have also been a Navi. So that's how they establish this. Iyov, based on Sefer Iyov. And then the remainder of these individuals are mentioned in Sefer Iyov. These are the friends of Iyov, and that give him advice and speak to him about that which is transpiring. And so the Gemara over here views those as being Nevi'ei Umot Olam. And their connection to Iyov, or being found in Sefer Iyov, is what classifies them as being Nevi'ei Umot Olam. And based on that, they are considered to be Nevi'im, or Gdolim, of the non-Jewish nations. The Gemara says, V'litamech, Elihu ben Brachel, Lav Yisrael Hava? Wait a minute, you're enumerating here, Elihu ben Brachel, and suggesting that he was one of the Nevi'ei Umot, and he wasn't Jewish. V'aktiv, mi mishpachat Ram. It says when describing Elu ben Brachel Abuzi, it says that he was from the family of Ram. And Rashi says, what does it mean, mi mishpachat Ram? So verse Rashi indicates mishpachat Ram means, why would you be miyaches, a non-Jew, to a family if Bnei Yisrael are not familiar with that family? Be miyaches to a family is only true when it deals with within Klal Yisrael. The fact that they speak about his family in particular is indicative of the fact that he must have been Jewish. Or, he says, Mishpachat Ram, actually gives another interpretation, is that he was Mi Avraham, that he was from Avraham. And Mishpachat Ram means that he was a descendant of Avraham. So if that's the case, how could you indicate that he was a Navi for Umot Olam when in fact he was Jewish? And by the way, that would answer our question regarding Iyov as well. Because that means that the list is enumerating people who are really Jewish and calling them Nevi'ei Umot Olam. So when it says, Elo Inbui Invei Umot Olam, he gave Nevu'ah to the non-Jewish nations, but he was Jewish. Al-Khanami, you can say the same thing about Iyov. Inbui Invei Umot Olam, he gave Nevu'ah for the other nations, but he was still Jewish. So that's no question from this Braita. When it says, Atukul Nevi'ei Milo Inbui Umot Olam, wait a minute, if you're going to say that that's the description, we have plenty of nevuot in Yechezkel, in Yirmiyahu, even in Yishayahu, that deal with the other nations of the world. So why don't you call them Nevi'ei Umot Olam? Because their nevuot also reference or deal with other nations. You have all of these mentions of other nations and predictions about other nations. Where it says, Hotam Ikar Nevuot Ayu LeYisrael. Over there, those individuals, the primary nevuah that they have, or the primary quantity and overarching themes of the Nevuot are referencing to Bnei Yisrael. As part of that, they mention other nations, but that's not their primary Nevuah. Hacha Iker Nevuot Ayol Umot Olam. Over here, the majority or the primary Nevuot that they have related to the non-Jewish nations, and that's why they're called Nevi'ei Umot Olam. Meitave, Chasid Ayab Umot Olam, V'Yov Shemo. There was this Chassid amongst the other nations, and his name was Iyov, as otherwise known as Chassidei Umota Olam. That was Iyov. V'lo Bale Olam, Elikat Kadei Lekabel Scharo. And he only came to the world in order to collect his Sachar. Hevi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Olav Yisurim, Hashem brought upon him all these difficulties. Chitchil Mecharef Migadef. He went ahead and he was blaspheming and cursing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So then Hashem doubles his reward in the end in order to give him everything in Olam Hazeh and have nothing remaining in Olam Haba. So there are two things about this. One is that it's clear from this Braita that Iyov was Chassidei Umot Olam. He was not Jewish. Number two from this Braita is a very negative view of Iyov as opposed to what we saw before. And the Pashtut of Sukkim is that Iyov is a good person. And that his goodness in the end shines through, and that's why he's rewarded in the end, because he's able to survive all the difficulties that he undergoes. So here, this has a very different take on Iyov. It's a negative take on Iyov, as well as the fact that he's from the other nations. And then that would be a problem for Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar again. Gemara says, Tenna Ehi. It is a machloket Tanaim as to whether Iyov was Jewish or whether he was me umot ha'ulam. Now we're going to have a list of Tanaim with opinions about who Yov was. And from that, we will see that the opinions, some indicate he was from Klal Yisrael, and some indicate that he was from the non-Jewish nations. And that's what it means. It's a machloket Tanaim. So Rabbi Elazar and Yochanan can align themselves with the Tanaim that believe that he is me Yisrael, and not with those Tanaim that believe that he was me umot ha'ulam. The Tanya, Rabbi Elazar Omer, Yov b'mei shvot ha'shoftim haya. He was at the time of the shoftim, shenemar. Because the pasuk in Yov says, Hein atem kuchem chazitem velama zehevel tebalu. All of you have seen, and why are you embracing this folly? Ezu dor shukulo hevel. Which generation was a generation of folly, a generation of emptiness? Avi Omer zedoro shoshvot ha'shoftim. That is the generation of the shoftim. It was a very problematic generation in terms of both what the Navi describes about what's going on there. Isha Yashar b'Einav Yaseh, people did as they pleased, as well as the fact that we're going to see in a second that the way that they treated their leaders or the questionable leadership that they have also was a problem during their generation. Yeshua ben Karchomer, Iyov b'mei Achashverosh haya. Iyov was at the time of Achashverosh, Shneamar, V'lo nimtza nashim yafot kibnot Iyov b'chol ha'aretz. They were not found in the land more beautiful women than the daughters of Iyov. Ezu dor shnitpakshu bo nashim yafot. Which generation were they searching for beautiful women? Av Yomer zedoro shel Achashverosh. That was the generation of Achashverosh. So here you have a correlation between the time of Achashverosh and here, but it's not simply that they were looking for beautiful women, but in the Iyov it says v'lo nimtza. They were not found. So what it means, lo nimtza, sounds like somebody was searching and they didn't find any more beautiful. Why were they searching? So that's the Gemara's connection to Achashverosh, that they were searching because in the time of Achashverosh, they were searching for beautiful women. The Gemara says, why don't you say, maybe made David? In the time of David, they were also looking. They were looking for a young maiden to keep David warm. It says, Hotam b'chol gvul Yisrael. There, it was only within the borders of Eretz Yisrael and the borders of Israel. Over here, we're talking about Chol Aretz, in the whole world. That was true in the time of Achashverosh, because they ruled over the large part of the world at that time. And therefore, when we say they searched high and low throughout the kingdom, all through a Chol Aretz. So that's what it says here in Iyov, it says Bechol Aretz, that there was nobody more beautiful in all the lands like the daughters of Iyov. Third opinion, Rabbi Natan Omer, Iyov b'mei malchut Shiva haya. He was at the time of the kingdom of Shiva. Shenemar v'tipol Shiva v'tikachem. So here again in Iyov Aleph, it describes what transpires to Iyov after the Satan gets involved, and slowly but surely, after the Satan is given permission to deal with Iyov, bad thing after bad thing happens to Iyov, and messengers one after the next are coming to him and giving him information about what happened. One of those messengers comes and says, Umalach ba'al Iyov, ve'yomar bakara yu chorshot. The oxen were plowing, batonot ro'ot, and the chamorim were out grazing ayudeim, vatipol shiva, vatikachem. All of a sudden they were plundered by shiva, and he walked off with them. Ve'tanarim iku lefi charev. And they killed the workers. I'm the only remnant of those individuals, and I came to tell you the news. So you see here, by Tipo Shiva, they were attacked by these individuals or these peoples of Shiva. So he says that Iyov must have been at the time of Malchut Shiva, which we'll see in a second, also comes up in the beginning of Sefer Melachim, because Malkat Shiva comes to Shlomo HaMelech, the queen of Shiva. So that Shiva, the Gemara is associating the two together and saying, during the kingdom of Shiva, that's what happens here in the time of Iyov. V'chamim omrim, Chamim suggests that Iyov b'mei Kazdim haya. He was at the time of the Kazdim, the Babylonians, because again there's another messenger that comes. Odzeh medaber, he was still speaking, v'zeba, and another messenger comes. Yomar, Kazdim samu shlosha roshim, v'shtetu al agmalim, they came and attacked the camels, v'yikachom. And then the young lads they killed by the sword. And I was the only one who escaped to come and tell you this news. So you see here again, he was plundered by the Kazdim. So that's what the Chamim say, that he was in the time of Kazdim. Shnemar, Kazdim samu shlosha roshim, which is the psukim that I just read to you. Ve'yishom imiyov v'me Yaakov haya, that he was in the time of Yaakov, v'dina bat Yaakov nasa, and he married Dina, the daughter of Yaakov. Tivacha, it says here in Iyov, tomer lo yishto, utcha machazik betumatecha, are you still staying with your tamim, your simple-mindedness, barei chalukim bamut, that you bless God and die? V'yomer leha kedaber achat nevelot tidaberi. Are you going to speak like one of these impious or impious individuals who speaks? You're speaking like one of the terrible individuals out there. Gam et ha-tov nekabel me et elokim, ve et ha-ra lo nekabel. We only accept good from God, not bad. Chozot lo chata Yov bisfatav. Nevertheless, Yov would not utter something that was wrong or ill against God. But you see that he refers to his wife as a nivalah. He uses that terminology and compares her to a nivalah. Devotam, and when Yaakov is speaking about what happened to Dina, it says, Ki nivala subi Israel. So the term nivala is used or associated with Dina, as well as the nivalot over here when he's speaking to his wife, and he says, he uses the term nivala as well. So the correlation between the two suggests that his wife was Dina bat Yaakov, because this association of the nivala. So Gemara says, Bikuleu tanae. Here there's a question about the gear, so we'll read what it says here and then I'll explain to you the other issue. Kula utanae, olotanae sfirlo di yob misrael ava, the bar mi yeshomrim. All of these individuals over here, all the Tanaim that are mentioned as Braita, believe that Iyov was Jewish, with the exception of the Yeshomrim, which is Yeshomrim, Iyov bime Yaakovaya, that it was the time of Yaakov. Obviously, if he's at the time of Yaakov, he's not from Yaakov's family, he wasn't Jewish. But all the others believe that he was a Jew or part of Klai Yisrael. If you think that he was from amongst the nations, Batar the Shachiv Moshe, Mishar Yeshchina Lovdei Kochavim. Because after the death of Moshe, we have a Mesorah, we'll see in a second from Alimut, in the Psukim, that there was no more Nivuah given to the other nations. After the time of Moshe, Nivuah remained solely with the Bnei Yisrael, and not with the other nations. So given the fact that all the other Chachamim identify Iyov as being post the time of Moshe, the only way that he could have gotten Nivuah was if he was a part of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, by definition, all those Tanaim must believe that he's part of Klal Yisrael, with the exception of the Yeshomrim, who say that he was prior to Moshe, and he was also at a time where there was no Klal Yisrael, there was only the family of Yaakov. There is an alternate girsa here, which is V'kulu Amora'ei V'Tanae. That not only all the Tanaim, but also the Amoraim believed that he was from Klal Yisrael. That would be because Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar also believed that Iyov was from Klal Yisrael. The problem with that is that Rova, on the previous Amud, said that he was B'mei Meraglim. And that would indicate that he wasn't part of Klal Yisrael, as well as the person speaking to Rabbi Shmuel Nachmani, who thinks he doesn't exist. Both of them don't think that he's a member of Klal Yisrael. So that's why Tosafot takes out the Girsa and thinks that the Girsa of Amoraye is incorrect, even though that's found in the Rabbeinu Chananel. You can see, he quotes the Rabbeinu Chananel saying it, as well as you can see in the Rabbeinu Gershom, that he says, Ve'amoraye kari the Rabbi Yochanan or Rabbi Lazar. So he limits, it's clear that he has a Girsa of Tanae v'Amoraye, and to deal with Tosafot's problem, he says Amoraye are referring to Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Lazar, and not the other Amorayim. But in the end, what you have here now is that most of them believe that Iyov was actually Jewish, which would corroborate what we said before, that it is a machloket tanaim, as to whether Iyov was Mi'Yisrael Hayah or he was Mi'Umot Olam, and that would then give Tanaic support to Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yochanan. And the source for the fact that there is no Ashrat HaShchina on the Goyim after the time of Moshe Rabbeinu is based on the Pasuk that's found by the Egel, V'amamar, Bikesh Moshe Shlo Tishra Shechina Alov Dei Kochavim V'natano. Moshe requested of God that he will no longer have his presence be manifest amongst the non-Jewish nations, and Hashem granted it to him. Shneamar, he says, V'niflinu Ani V'amcha. Basically, Moshe is demanding to know, after God forgives Bnei Yisrael for the Egel Azav, how are we going to know that we are different than the other nations? If you send your Malach with us, we're going to be no different than the other nations. So Moshe wants something that distinguishes Bnei Yisrael. That distinguishment is, number one, that Hashem is manifest and not the Malach. And number two is the Nivu'ah. And that's what it means here, that the God grants him that request, that the Bnei Yisrael would be unique, then they'd be the only ones that have Ashrat HaShchina, and that would identify that Hashem has forgiven them, and given them this unique aspect that they are able to communicate with God or have a Shvet HaShchinah and have Nevi'im. So that means post-Moshe, there wasn't the case. Obviously, Bilam is a contemporary of Moshe and already had Nevoah before Moshe asked for this. And therefore, his Nevoah is not in contradiction to this. Rabbi Yochanan, Doro Shel Yov Shituf Bezima Haya, they were adulterous, illicit relations, promiscuous behavior, were all a part of the generation of Yov. Shenemar, Heinatem Kuchem Chazitem, Balam Ezeh Hevel Tebalu, that's the same pasuk that we quoted before, that all of you have seen, and why are you embracing the folly? But now the Gemara says that they're looking at the word Nechazeh or Chazitem, and concluding that that has an agadic gezerah shava for zimak tiv. It says in Shir Hashirim, Shuvi Shuvi Ashulamit, Shuvi Shuvi Nechazebach. It says, come back to Shulamit, come back, let me see you. Obviously that seeing over here is a seeing of a desire to see in Shir Hashirim. It's thinking about the seeing of the woman. So too, the seeing that he's referencing to in Eov is also the seeing of women, or this idea that they were shutuf be-zima. And Rashi adds on, Lashon zima huze, istakel b'nashim, shuvdei kochavim amin liso, shuvi l'toratenu, v'tizini imanu. Come back to our Torah and be mizaneh along with us. So that's the parallel in Shir HaShirim. If you don't take it literally that he's looking at the woman, the idea is that the other nations are trying to convince us to leave Hashem. Nechzebach, come and join us in your adulterous relationship, come with us, and therefore you will leave Hashem. So that's what the Nechaz says. Ema b'nevuah. Why did you say it's nevuah? Dechtev, chazon ishayah ben amos. So the word chazeh or chazon also refers to nevuah. Im kema, lama zehevel te'abalu lamali. But then the end of the pasuk doesn't make sense. If you say it's talking about zima, then you can understand the critical aspect of the latter part of the pasuk, which is, why are you embracing this hevel? On the other hand, if you say that it's nevuah, what does it mean? Why are you embracing this hevel? That's something positive. Therefore, it doesn't match with the latter part of the pasuk. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, my dichtiv, what is meant in the pasukim va'yiv bimei shfot ha-shoftim in the beginning of Rut? Dor sheshofet et shoftav. It's a generation that judges its judges. Omer lo, if the judge comes to him and gives him musar and says, tol kisei mi ben either einecha or shinecha, take out that little toothpick or piece between your teeth or between your eyes. Omer lo, the person responds to them and doesn't take the musar to heart, but rather says, tu korah mi ben einecha. Why don't you take that big beam out from between your eyes? So kiseim refers to a small piece of wood or a small thing that gets caught between the teeth. A korah is obviously a very large beam or piece of wood. And what they're saying is that the leaders are coming and trying to chastise the people. The people respond, before you come and chastise us, why don't you take care of the big holes that are visible in you? Because the leaders were also problematic. They were not leaders that were pure and clean of sin, but rather they were full of sin and a big avirot gedolot. And their people are saying to them, why are you bothering us about our small sins? You should take care of your big sins before you come and chastise us. Amar lo, the shofet would say to the people, kaspei chaya l'sigim, your silver has become like dross. Amar lo, and then they would respond, saveich mahol b'mayim, that your wines have been diluted by water.
So the leader is claiming that they're cheating with regards to the purity of their silver, and they're flipping it back to them and saying, you're cheating with regards to the quality of your wine. So if you think we are engaged in ona'ah, you're no better, you're engaged in that same ona'ah.
So the same idea, which is that you make one claim, they would just shoot it right back in their face and say, listen, you're trying to get us to do good and take care of what we've done wrong? Clean your act up first before you come and speak to us. So that, in a sense, diffuses the effectiveness of the leaders of the generation, because nobody's going to listen to them because the leaders of the generation are so corrupt or problematic. And from that, you're going to end up with a lack of leadership during that period of time because the people don't look up to their leaders. Amar Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani bar Yochanan, kol amer malkat shiva isha ita, enu ela toeh. Anybody who thinks that malkat shiva, who comes to visit Shlomo HaMelech, that she was the queen of shiva, and that she was a woman, he's mistaken. My Malkat Shiva, what does it mean? Malchuta de Shiva. It means the kingdom of Shiva. And that the representatives of Shiva came to see Shlomo HaMelech. It wasn't that the queen came. Right, Queen Sheba. The real problem is that all the psukim there reference the Malkat Shiva as being in the Keva, Lashon Nekeva. So the Marsha notes over here that that's what it means. It means that don't think that she was the queen because she was married to the queen. Is that because she was married to the king? So don't think that the title came to her because of her husband. Rather, she was Malkat Sheba. She was the ruler. She was the queen. So that's how the Marsha gets around the problem of being Lashon Nekeva and the statement of Rabbi Yonatan. Vayayom vayavo bnei Elokim leitzeyatzev al Hashem vayavo gam ha-satan betucham vayom ha-shem al-satan ma'ayin tavo? Where are you coming from? Vayana satan. And then the satan answers him. And this is the beginning of Sefer Iyov and what precipitates the problem, because Hashem asks him, where did you come from? And then after asking him from where did he come from, the satan answers, and the Gemara here is going to darshan the answer of the satan to indicate that there was some sort of comparison or issue going on over here. He says, "Vayomer Hashem Satan, Ma'ayin Tavo Be'en Satan Hashem Yomer Mishut Ba'aretz." I was floating on the land, Umitalech Ba, and I was walking amongst it. Vayomer Hashem Al Satan. Then Hashem says to Satan, "Hasamta Libcha Al Abdi Yov? Have you taken note of my great servant Yov? Kein Kamo Ba'aretz. There's nobody like him in the land. Ishtam. He is a man of a simpleness, but a integrity. V'yashar, and he is straight." V'yarei Elokim, fears God, v'sumera, and distances himself from evil. So now the Satan then says, is that really true? That's because everything's going well for him. Since everything's going well, he's obviously a good servant. If things start to turn on him, he won't be a good servant. And Hashem gives then the Satan permission to attack Iyov, anything of his possessions, all of his that he owns and his children, but he can't touch Iyov himself. So that's what the Gemara there is dashing. What happened? The Satan says, I floated through the whole world, and I never one found anyone who was as faithful to you as Abraham Avinu. That you said about him, go through the land from its length and its width. So the Gemara talks about going through the land. Connecting to what the Satan did, Mishut Baretz V'italeich Ba. That he floated through the land and he walked in it. And what was the greatness of Abraham? Even at the time where he didn't find a place to bury his own wife, he paid some exorbitant price. He never questioned you, Hashem. So here the Satan comes and says, Abraham, the greatest servant of God. Hashem says, wait a minute, what about Iyov? Maybe Iyov exceeds Abraham. The descriptors that are used in the Psukim to describe Iyov are even greater than those of Abraham. At the Akedah, God says to Abraham, now I know that you really fear God because you did what I said and you brought your son up as a korban. And we just saw in the Psukim in Iyov, he's defined as an ishtam, viyashar, yirei elukim, visar meira. So he had all of these accolades that are associated with him, and Avraham only gets a small amount. The Achronim over here, the Marsha discusses it, in defense of Avraham say that we have a principle that you only say miksat shvacho shelefanav. You only say the portion of someone's shevach to him himself, but when you describe them outside of the context of the individual, you can say everything. So they say, Avraham, Hashem was speaking directly to Avraham. That's why only he mentioned Yirei Elokim. On the other hand, Iyov, where it's a narrative, and they're speaking outside the context of Iyov, over there you can give all of these accolades. Despite that, what the Marsha points out is that it's still, there's such a gap between Yirei Elokim by Avraham and that which is mentioned by Iyov. That's what precipitates the statement of Rabbi Yochanan, that the descriptors given to Iyov exceed those of Avraham. My v'sar meira. What does it mean that he avoided evil? Amarav Abba Bar Shmuel, Iyov vatran b'mamono haya. He was extremely generous with his money. Minago shel olam, the normal way of the world is, noten chatzi pruta lechenvani, that when you pay the poel, when you pay the worker, say the worker earns half a pruta, then what you do is you go to the storekeeper and say to him, give him a full pruta, and say, take care of this individual, half a pruta worth of merchandise he'll be able to take, the other half will be changed to me. But Iyov vitra mishelo. The other hand, Iyov gave up that other half pruta to the poel and said, just take the change, keep the change. So he was surmeira. He stayed away from
the practice of being miserly or the practice of being makpid on their own money. And that's why it turns him as a sar meira. Others also point out to the Gemara in Sanhedrin by the Shiva Mitzvah B'nei Noach that over there, the Gemara says that generally a Jew is not makpid unless than a pruta, is mochel on it. But a ben Noach or a goy is not mochel unless than a shaveh pruta. And for that reason that there is punishment by gnevar gzela of a goy, even b'pachot mishaveh pruta. But for a Jew, it has to be over the threshold of a shaveh pruta. So over here, it was less than a shaveh pruta, upon which normally the minagol shel olam is that the goy or the ben Noach is makpid on it. Despite that fact, Iyov was not makpid on it, and that's what his greatness was, that he went against the minagol shel olam, and that he was mavir al midotav, or mavir on what other people were makpid on in terms of the money or the half pruta that was supposed to be changed to him, he would be mavater and give it to the poel and give it to the worker. And you can see in the Rabbeinu Gershom that he reads it as that his midot were not like his friends, v'sameira shloita midatok midat re'av. That sur meira means sur me'reya. He was different than his friends. He was different than his peers in the way that he conducted himself, and therefore they're reading it as sur meira, as sur me'reya, that he differentiated his nature from those around him. But that speaks to this greatness of Iyov, that he wasn't just the Yirei Elokim, but he's also a sar meira. He was someone who avoided doing anything wrong, that he took extra precaution to ensure that nothing bad happened. And that's why he turns him as a sar meira. So then the Gemara continues with the psukim there in the first paragraph of Iyov and says, Vayana satan Hashem, Vayoma achinam yarei Iyov elukim. Is it for naught that Iyov fears God? Alo ata sachto. In the psukim it's written with a sin and not a samach. Ba'do ba'ad beito. You have provided him with all of his needs. Here the Gemara uses the word v'chule, but in the psukim it says, lo ata sachta ba'do ba'ad beito ba'ad kol ha'shelo misaviv. Masei yada berachta u'mikneyu paratz baretz. You have blessed him with everything around him. He has endless wealth, and all of his activities, everything he does, goes well. And then the Satan says, v'ula, shlachna yadcha v'gav b'chol ha'shelo. Why don't you go ahead and see when you start taking away all these goodies, if he still continues to bless you, or lashon saginohar, is he really going to bless you and not curse you in that situation? Mardashin's about those psukim, maima seyada berachto, that the workings of his hand and anything that he involved with was blessed. Maroshmo bar Rabbi Yitzchak konotel pruta miyov mitparech. Anybody who took a pruta from miyov was blessed. And maybe this is the source for the practice that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, that when he used to go visit him, he would give anybody who visited him a dime to give to tzedakah. That if you got a dime from the Rebbe, then you would be mitbarech. So maybe that's the origins of that practice. Mai umikneu paratz baretz. What does it mean that his flocks exploded or were spread over the land? Am Rabbi Yossi Berchanina mikneu shayov partzu gidro shel olam. They broke the fences of the world, meaning that they were not like the standards of other animals. Minagos shel olam is ivim or gima izim. In general, the way it works is that the wolves eat the goats. Mikneu shel Iyov, on the other hand, the flocks of Iyov, izim or gima tzeivim. The goats were killing the wolves. And then Hashem basically acquiesces to the challenge of the Satan. Ayom Hashem ha-Satan, hinei kol ha-shelo b'yadecha. Everything that he has is in your hands now. Rak elav al tishlach yadecha. Just you may not put your hand on him. V'yitzeh ha-satan mim pnei Hashem. And the Satan leaves. And then we have all of a sudden all the stories that we spoke about before, where the malachim, the messengers are coming and starting to bring all the bad news to Iyov. So the Gemara says, v'ulam shlachna yadcha v'gab b'chol ha-shelo, lo apanecha yivarecheka. Again, yivarecheka we said was in a lashon z'nagayinor. And then it continues, it says, his children were celebrating, they were eating and drinking wine by their oldest brother. And then the messenger comes to Yov, the oxen were plowing, and the donkeys were grazing by them, and then we were attacked.
by the people of Sheva, and they stole them. It's an Arim Hikulifi Charev, and they killed all the workers that were there. And I was the only one to escape and come and tell you to bring you this news. So the Gemara wants to know, what does it mean that the oxen were plowing and that the donkeys were eating alongside them? That Hashem gave a taste of Olam Haba to Iov, because it says in Yirmiyahu, Hiravi Yoledetz Yachdav, that they will conceive and give birth together, meaning that there will be no delay between the conception and the birth. And the same thing is true over here, where they are darshan over here, that you won't have to wait. On the same day that the cows and the oxen are plowing in the field, already the donkeys can graze in that field. And that what they went one way and plowed, already by the time they're coming back, it's already grown and providing grazing for the donkeys. That's quote-unquote me'ein olam haba, because of the fact that there is no delay anymore. There isn't the delay of planting and emerging. There's no delay of conception and birth. So too by Eov, that's what's being described here. At the same time that the oxen are plowing, the donkeys are grazing, because the feed already emerged from the ground right after they had plowed it, and that is min olam haba. So then we'll continue again with the Gemara's description or explanation of these psukim in Iyov and Perek Aleph tomorrow. So we'll stop here on the first line on the top of Tetzayin Amud Aleph.